everybody to the Kollel's annual Rosh Hashanah symposium of all the Kollel's events. I think it's the Rosh Hashanah symposium that's the most special to me personally, and that's because we have the opportunity to partner and to bring together Chashuvim, Rabbanim, and leaders from the community that work tirelessly on behalf of the community in so many different ways, ways that we know about, ways that we don't know about, and strengthening the spiritual infrastructure of the Tzibur, the physical infrastructure of the Tzibur, giving guidance to us personally, and therefore it's really a tremendous honor for us to partner with the Chashuvim, the Rabbanim that we have with us here tonight. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah on Daf Tezayin Amud Beis, Amar Reb Yitzchak, Kol Shana She'ein Toikin La B'Tchilasa Marien La B'Sofa. Any year that we don't blow the shofar at the beginning, meaning Rosh Hashanah, it ends up being a very difficult and hard year at the end. We see from this short memra of Rabbi Yitzchak that this mitzvah of Tekiyas Shofar has tremendous potency and powers of protection to save us from harm and evil, and to convey bracha and blessing and bounty on us. What is the secret of this mitzvah, of this blowing of the shofar? As well, to what circumstance does the Gemara refer when it says that if one does not blow the shofar, is that a situation where he was careless, or even a situation that presented itself that was beyond our control, what we'll call in halacha an ones? We know generally Torah principle that ones rachmana patre, if a situation arises that a person cannot fulfill a mitzvah, he's exempt, there's no liability. Perhaps it's talking about if Rosh Hashanah fell out on a Shabbos. We know that Chazal instituted a decree. The sages declared that if Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, we don't blow the shofar, for the reason that the possibility that somebody would take the shofar and carry it, Dalet Amos, 4 cubits, in a public domain, and thereby transgress the Shabbos. Tosfos over there in Rosh Hashanah cites the Bahag that addresses the issue of the circumstance. And he says, Lav de mikla b'shabaso, ela de isyalid unsa. The situation is not that Rosh Hashanah fell out on the Shabbos. That would be subject to this situation where, God forbid, it would be a very difficult year. Rather, an ones happened, something beyond our control. We weren't able to blow the shofar. This Bahag seems to be very problematic. First of all, if it's a situation of ones beyond our control, so why isn't the principle applicable? We're exempt. There's no liability. Ones rachmana patre. And if for some reason that's not applicable over here for this mitzvah, why doesn't it apply likewise if Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos? Turning our attention back to where the power of the shofar is rooted, ultimately, we could get back to understanding the position of the Bahag. The Gemara in the Amud earlier says a memra, a statement in the name of Rabbi Avohu, Lama token b'shofar shel ayil. Why do we blow, why do we use the horn of a ram? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, tiku lefanai b'shofar shel ayil. Use a shofar shel ayil, use that to blow. Kidei she'eskar lechem akedas Yitzchak ben Avraham. In order that I remember for you, the akedah, where Avraham offered up Yitzchak. Now the Gemara continues, Umala ani aleichem kilo akaratam atzmichem lefanah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, and I will consider it through the blowing of the shofar as if you offered yourself up. Clearly, the power of the shofar is rooted in the akedah. But how is this accomplished? And what is the meaning of these words that I will consider it as if you offered yourself up? The Sefer HaChinuch in Mitzvah Shin Lamed Aleph, he says, Shatakiya hahi, the blowing that we do on Rosh Hashanah, Anu osim l'kova machshavtenu al inin akedas Yitzchak. In order to set our thoughts on the story of the Akedah. V'nitzayir b'nafshenu lasseis gam anu kemohu la'avas Hashem Yisparach. And to illustrate in our heart vividly that we would do the same. We would offer up what's dear to us for the sake of heaven. U'mitoch kach, and through this, yala zichroneinu lifnei Hashem l'toiv. Our merit will ascend to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for good. Klomar shniya zekayim lefanav. We will be found meritorious in front of Him. The chinuch is clear. The mitzvah, the power of the shofar, is rooted in our ability to duplicate the mesiras nefesh, the selflessness, the devotion in our hearts of Avraham and Yitzchak, Tavinu Shebashemayim, to our Father in Heaven. Rav Sadia Gaon famously cites 10 reasons why we blow the shofar, and among them is also the Akedah. And these are his words, Lahazkirenu Akedas Yitzchak, to remember the Akedah, the binding of Yitzchak, Shemaser Nafshe L'Shemayim, he gave up, was willing to give up his life to Heaven. And he continues, V'chein anachnu nimsar nafshenu, so too we are willing to give up our lives. Al kudusha shemai, for the sake of Hashem, v'yala zichroneinu. And through that, our merit will ascend heavenward. Understanding the shofar and how he evokes the akedah, and how the akedah is supposed to forge in our own heart this wellspring of devotion, of love, of selflessness, of sacrifice to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we could return to the Bahag and try to understand it. The Meshech Chachma indeed explains the Bahag with these concepts that we just spoke. And he says, firstly, the reason that we don't simply apply the regular principle of Onis Rachman Apatre, that when somebody's in a circumstance beyond his control, he's exempt, and therefore we shouldn't apply the fact that the year will be difficult, is because over here, shofar is different than other mitzvahs. Somebody was precluded somehow from shaking lulav and esrog. There's no blame. There's no liability. But shofar acts differently. It acts like a shield. It's like a medicine. It's an elixir, the Meshech Chachma says. Imagine a sick person. As doctor orders to take a certain medicine, and bandits come and they steal it from him and he's unable to take it. There's no blame. There's no carelessness. But still the medicine is not taken. The shofar has unique power to protect us, to to bring shefa, to bring bounty and bracha on us. And that's done through the way the Gemara explained, through the chinuch and Psad Yigon, by evoking those feelings of mesiras nefesh, of selfless devotion to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The question remains, if so, the medicine wasn't taken, the shield wasn't there, so habit of Shabbos falls out in Rosh Hashanah. Still, there's no blame, there's no liability. But the shofar wasn't done. The power wasn't unleashed. We don't have its protection. And here the Meshech Chachma says something astounding. He says, why aren't we blowing the shofar? Because we're concerned lest somebody transgress Shabbos. Inadvertently, he'll carry in a public domain. And we tell HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's true, we could be in a very precarious situation. We don't have the protection of shofar to protect us. It's Yom HaDin. Everything's being determined. Our lives, our health, our parnasa, our children, our hatzlacha. We give that up for you. Chas v'shalom, God forbid, that Shabbos should be transgressed. And we willingly deny ourselves the protection of the shofar for kavod shemayim, for the sake of the honor of heaven. That, the Meshech Chachma says, that selflessness, that willingness to sacrifice everything for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, itself stands as a merit for us. That same theme, that same power, that same concept of mesiras nefesh, of devotion, that the shofar does, that the Akedah evokes, is here in our devotion to HaKadosh Baruch Hu when we say, we're not going to blow the shofar. Because God forbid, your Shabbos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be transgressed. When we talk about Mesiras Nefesh, self-sacrifice, nobody wants to sacrifice. It's painful. It's very difficult. And I thought it worthwhile to cite the beautiful words of Reb Shamshon Raphael Hirsch when he talks about, so to speak, sacrifice. And his words are found at the beginning of Vayikra. And he comes, his goal is to properly translate the word karbon, which is often translated as sacrifice. And he says that's a very poor translation. That's not what a karban is. He's not very fond of the word offering either. And he says to understand what a karban is, not surprisingly, Reb Hirsch says, you have to look at the word karban. And where does that come from? And it comes from the word krav. As an exception to my general policy of not to read something more than a couple of sentences inside when I speak, I think it's bad form. The words of Reb Hirsch are so beautiful and inspiring and illuminating. I'm going to read them inside if you don't mind, with your indulgence. And he continues, the meaning of karav is in accord with its plain sense, to draw closer, to arrive at a close relationship with someone. It follows, then, that the purpose and the result of hakrava is a positive attainment, the realization of a more noble existence, and that the opposite, destruction, annihilation, and loss, should not be ascribed to it. It also follows that a karban serves to meet the needs of the makriv, the one who's offering it, and not the needs of the one to whom the karban is brought near. The will of the makriv is that something of his own should come into closer relationship with God. This is the very essence of a karban, and the act that is designed to bring this about is called hakrava, drawing near. The purpose of a karban is to seek God's nearness, which for a Jew is the sole good, without which he feels behemos, beast-like, stripped of the true calling of a human being. In God's sanctuary, a man will understand that closeness to God is the sole criterion for shaping his outlook on life and for evaluating his true happiness. There in the Devir and the Heichal in the temple, he will see clearly that his spiritual and material happiness will flourish only through closeness to God and the rule of his law, and that this is his ultimate calling. There in the Chatzar, he will learn that the only way to attain God's nearness is total dedication to the illuminating, purifying, life-giving fire of the Torah. There, life's riddles are solved. There, the measure of one's happiness is determined by the measure of one's closeness to God. And Reb Hirsch concludes, hence, happiness loses its appeal if found far from God. While in God's nearness, suffering is sweetened and even transformed into good. For in God's sanctuary, every spirit, every soul is refined to understand and feel what is truly good for man. I think when we contemplate about the shofar, about the Akedah, about what the shofar's calling really is, for selfless devotion to Hashem, and we assimilate Reb Hirsch's perspective, could be difficult, Mesiras Nefesh, but it's not a loss. We take something ephemeral, something transient, and we make it eternal. We take something physical and material, and we make it spiritual. We take everyday moments and we consecrate it and make it sublime. It's a pretty good deal. The story is told of Vilna Gaon. In his last moments before he passed away, he held his tzitzis and he cried. And he said, for a few kopecks, for a few pennies in Olam Hazeh, you could buy a beged, you could buy a tzitzis, and do a mitzvah that's eternity. This is an opportunity that we have. And as we come and contemplate about the Yom HaDin, about Rosh Hashanah, perhaps we could look at opportunities that we have to take time, maybe look a little closer, we could find more time for Torah study. We could find more time to do chesed. We could look at our resources. We can invest in our community. We could lend a hand to the needy. We could find stubborn places in our heart of grievance and complaint and offer in instead love and forgiveness. In the Meretz Hashem, that will be our own Akedah and bring us and our families much bracha and hatzlacha for the new year. We have the honor of partnering closely with the Southeast Hebrew congregation and Rabbi Ryan, very dear relationship both personally and professionally, and we have great gratitude to Rabbi Ryan and the shul for all we do together and for sharing its space. And everybody knows over here, I don't have to speak lengthily about Rabbi Ryan's scholarship and his leadership and his goodness to us. And without further ado, it's a great pleasure to call on Rabbi Ryan to address us.
A very good evening, everyone. Yeshe koach for joining. Yeshe koach, Rabbi Winter, as always. There's a great debate in the education world if it's better to run a program like this with the lights on, or it's better to run a kumzitz with the lights off. Rabbi Winter, you've proven yourself once again adaptable and able to meet whatever life throws you. I'd like to thank everyone for joining. We share a very precious bond in our appreciation of the Kollel and the work that it does, both here in Shul and throughout the greater Washington area. You should be zocha in the coming year to exceed your expectations. I extend a yeshar koach in advance to Rabbi Reingold on his talk coming shortly. We're looking forward. I'd like to take the opportunity to express a special welcome to Rabbi Weinberg. I believe it's his first time in our shul. In a variety of forums, we've had the privilege to sit together. And for me, it's a pleasure to appreciate your talent and dedication, and an honor to have you join us this evening. There's a section in Musaf of Rosh Hashanah, a somewhat lengthy section, called Zichronos, Remembrances. According to the Gemara, the reason for this section is Kidei Sheyala Zichronechem Lefanai Letova, Kaviyachol, so to speak, that we should remind Hashem of this precious relationship He has with us, with humanity, with the Jewish people, to remember Noah, to remember so much that the Nevi'im talk about. Zichronos, to remind Hashem. But on another level, Zichronos is to remind us of what we are capable of. Zichronos, the power of the Jewish memory. The Gemara in Yuma tells us, Hillel Mechayiv, Yosef Mechayiv. They were great people who lived and achieved greatness. They dealt with formidable challenges. And it's Mechayiv, it obligates us that we have to be like that too. Hillel, exceedingly poor. And nevertheless, he excelled in Torah. Yosef, handsome, vulnerable, popular, and he remained moral. They did it, so can you. Mechayev, you're obligated. But Mechayev is a heavy word. This is not about inspiration. This is not about making a recommendation. This is mechayiv. You know, if someone comes into a bezdin, a Jewish court, and there's a claim against him, $100, and the bezdin hears the case and does the cross-examination and issues the ruling chayiv, he's got to pay. Hillel, Yosef, they did it, they could do it, but what about me? How could you be machayev me? I once heard a story from Rav Matisyahu Salomon about Rav Shach. There was a Hasidic dynasty in Eretz Yisrael, and the mentor, the Rebbe, passed away, and he left two children. An older child, a younger child. And the question was, who would it be proper to appoint as the successor? So the older son was the older son. And the younger son was very capable. And Rav Shach heard the case. And he questioned and delved. And he issued his ruling. it should be given to the younger son. So one of the people who brought the question started arguing. He says, how could Rav Shach say that the younger son should get it? That's going to cause such terrible pain to the older son. It's a pasuk in Chumash. A pasuk by Aaron, when his younger brother Moshe was appointed, v'roach of v'somach belibo, he would rejoice, and for rejoicing, he became the Kohen Gadol with a choshen on his heart. What a remarkable thing for him to rejoice at his younger brother's success. It's not a simple thing. It's a big challenge. How can you do that to the older brother? And Rav Shach jumped out of his seat in frustration and shock. He said, that's the way you learn a pasuk chumash. That's the way you understand a verse in our holy Torah. Aaron did something remarkable, so it has nothing to do with you. What is this, Bible stories? Sipurim? Torah is a book of lessons. Now that Aaron showed that greatness could be done, he paved the way for you. Now you can do it. That's what Chazal tell us. Mosa yagiu maisai lema'ase avosai. When will I be able to emulate the behavior of great people? Yosef Mechayev. Yosef and his morality obligates. Today in our time, every moral distraction is available to us. Even with filtered internet. There are critical moments. Yosef Mechayev, Yosef reminds us it could be done. There are decisions to be made. The click. To read an article or not read an article. It's a decision. Yosef was able to do it. He did it. He paved the way for all future generations. What are you talking about? My great-grandfather did it. And if you're not from a shevet of Yosef, my great-uncle did it. I can do it too. Just yesterday was the Bikur Cholim Bikeathon. Close to 40 miles. So I asked one of the participants if he found it hard. So he told me it was hard, but he had a little strategy that worked for him. And he did fine. I said, what's the strategy? He says he did a 20-mile practice run. So for the first 20 miles, he kept reminding himself, 20 miles? I can do it. I did it already. I know I can do this. And after he passed the halfway mark, he said to himself, it's only 20 miles left. And I know I can do 20 miles. That's Yosef Mechayev. The Nishmas Yisrael has already done this. I can do it. Hillel Mechayev. Hillel, excessively poor. even with the greatest financial distractions, Hillel was able to do it. And he paved the way for us. I remember, if you'll allow me to be nostalgic, all the way back to pre-1A. I think today they call it kindergarten. We had a Rebbe well-versed in Yiddish. And he wished to bestow that gift upon us. And he told us, Torah is the best schayra. Torah is the best merchandise. My Yiddish didn't grow that much from then. But best schayra was embedded in my mind. It's a good deal. Person has distractions, but Hillel paved the way. I met a person not long ago, older gentleman, totally motivated to do chesed. Every opportunity he's got, he's everywhere. I asked him, what drives you? He said he grew up in a home. Young family after World War II. His parents were living here in America, raising a family. When they finally appreciated the tragedy of the Holocaust and the needs of the fledgling state of Israel. He says, my family was poor, but we still gave. My father was stressed for time at his business, but he still found time to solicit. He says, my father paved the way for me. Mechayev, it's empowering. It makes it possible. And so we look at the psukim in Zichronos. Zichronos is not just about reminding Hashem, so to speak, of rekindling that bond with Him. Zichronos is about us. To remember, Lechtech Acharai Bamidbar, we followed Moshe Rabbeinu into the desert. We didn't know what we were going to do for food and water. But we put our best foot forward, because we knew it was the right thing to do. The Jewish people, we do that all the time. We put our best foot forward without the vaguest idea how we're going to bring it to its final moment. Do good things, Chazal tell us, and good things will happen. Vayizaku b'nei Yisrael, the Jewish people were in a crisis in Mitzrayim and they called out to Hashem. Vayeda Elokim, and Hashem knew it's time to redeem them. And Moshe Rabbeinu is on deck, shepherding the sheep of Yisro, ready to be called into action. We've been in tough places before. Tefillah works. The Akedah that Rabbi Winter mentioned, the ability to sacrifice for something precious. And the favorite for many people, Haben Yakir Li Ephraim, the wayward son is welcomed back. Yeled Sha'ashuim, he's transformed to a delightful child. Go match that. The Navi's invitation. We've been there. Mechayev. Zichronos. Not just reminding Hashem, but reminding ourselves of what we are truly capable of. Ksiva v'chasima tova. Thank you for joining.
Ashokar Chabe Ryan, inspiring words. One of the wonderful things about the Rosh Hashanah Symposium is that often we have the opportunity to showcase one of the community leaders that other people outside their shul, the congregation, may not have the opportunity to hear. I've got to know Rabbi Weinberg. I met him shortly after he came, spoken to him, and I think that Rabbi Weinberg is really epitomizes Havi Talmidav Shal Aharon HaKohen, that he's Ohev HaSabriyos U'Mekarvim LaTorah. We get to know Rabbi Weinberg. He's a true model of ni'imos, of sweetness, of kavod habriyos, of understanding sensitivities of people, and that's matched with great scholarship and erudition. And not only is KMS been enriched with his presence, but all of Greater Washington. So it's an honor for us to have you speak on our behalf and to welcome you to the Kollel.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Winter, for that beautiful introduction. Hope to only be able to live up to the praises that you've given me and to become that person. It's inspiring to hear about what other people think of you, and hope that you can live up to that, and hope that, as Rabbi Ryan said, the path was paved before you so that I can help you a little bit to get there. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here and to speak this evening. I think it's a wonderful opportunity to get together, and I'm honored to speak alongside the three of you this evening, and I really appreciate all of your presence here. I said this in shul last night. It's something that I remark about every year in the week before Rosh Hashanah. I think that every moment in the week before Rosh Hashanah is of tremendous, tremendous significance. And it always strikes me, you know, that as you go through the week before Rosh Hashanah, it's the last of everything. It's, you know, the last Sunday night marav of the year. It's the last Monday morning shacharis of the year. And what that reminds me of is that every single moment is precious. What we do with these moments this week is of incredible significance. It sets the tone for how we end the year. It sets the tone for how we start the year. It sets our inspiration for Rosh Hashanah. And so taking time out tonight to be able to learn together and discuss together and come together, I think is an incredibly worthwhile opportunity. I hope to share a thought with you this evening that perhaps is useful in understanding Rosh Hashanah, perhaps useful in understanding the time period that we find ourselves in, and I hope it'll be useful in providing something tangible to hold on to in order to make the most of these precious moments as we lead up to the Yom HaDin. The thought I'd like to share with you this evening is a thought about the laning on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Now, most people speak about the laning of Rosh Hashanah. They tend to speak about the laning of the second day of Rosh Hashanah, the Akedah, as Rabbi Winter so beautifully spoke about earlier. And even if they speak about the laning of the first day, they tend to focus on the major stories of the laning of the first day, the birth of Yitzchak, the banishment of Hagar and Ishmael from the home of Avram Avinu. Those are the stories that people hold on to and that people learn from. What I'd like to focus on tonight is actually the end of the laning of the first day, perhaps a story that seems to be of lesser significance, a story that seems to be appended to the end of the laning of the first day, and that is the story of the bris of Avram and Avimelech, the story of the treaty that Avimelech and Avram make at the end of the laning. After the birth of Yitzchak and the banishment of Hagar and Ishmael from the home of Avram, the story kind of pans back to the home of Avram Avinu and tells us about this covenant that was made. The pasuk says, "Va'ata yishavali be'Elohim heina im tishkorli u'lenini u'lenachti kacheser asher asisi imcha taseh imadi v'im ha'aret asher garta ba." The request of Avram Avinu by Avimelech, the king of the Plishtim, was to make a covenant that they would be good to each other, that they would respect each other, that just as perhaps in the future Avimelech's descendants would respect Avram and his descendants, so too Avram and his descendants would respect them, and they would keep the peace between them. Avram Avinu, of course, agrees to make the covenant, makes some stipulations in the covenant, and they come into this treaty, this bris, this covenant, in the place of Be'er Sheva, which bears that name because of the covenant that was made over there. Avimelech goes home at the end of the story, and the Torah tells us what Avram Avinu did in response to this treaty. Pasuk says, "Va'yichasu bris b'Be'er Sheva." Vayakam Avimelech ufichol sar tzvo v'yashuv el eretz plishtim. Avimelech goes home. That part of the story is done. What does it say that Avram Avinu did? Two things. Vayita eshel b'Be'er Sheva. He plants a tree, according to the simple reading of the pasuk. Plants a tree in Be'er Sheva. Vayikra sham b'shem Hashem kel olam. And he calls out there in the name of Hashem, kel olam. I'm baffled by this story from so many perspectives. I have so many questions about the nature of this story. Question number one, why on earth would Avimelech want to make a bris with Avram Avinu? Avimelech was a strong, powerful king, an influential person in the area. Avram was 100 years old. He had just banished his son, his strong son, from his home. He had one baby, Yitzchak. Was amounted to nothing yet in his lifetime. What was he afraid of? Why was he interested in making a bris? Normally a person tries to make a peace treaty, a covenant with someone else when there is a threat, when they're afraid of something, when they see an opportune moment to come together and perhaps protect themselves for later. But why was Avimelech threatened by Avram and Yitzchak? Why was he interested in this treaty? Question number two. Why did Avram Avinu plant a tree in response to the treaty, the aftermath of the treaty? How is the planting of the tree connected in any way, or is it, to the treaty that was made? I would imagine a person makes a peace treaty, historic agreement between two parties. You'd come home, you'd make a parade, you'd make a festival, you'd make a big meal perhaps. Maybe you'd tear down the fences that protected your property, saying, now I can be safe, I don't need this protection anymore. But why would you plant a tree? What does it have to do with anything? How is it connected? Question number three. Why does Avram Avinu call out in the name of Hashem, Kel Olam? A new name we had never seen yet in the Chumash. I understand why Avram Avinu is calling out in the name of Hashem. That's what Avram Avinu does. But why doesn't he use names that are already familiar to us? Kone Shemayim Va'aretz, Hashem. Why does he call out in a name? Why does the Torah reveal to us a name that had never been used before? The fourth question that always bothered me was, why are we reading about this on Rosh Hashanah? Maybe we're just reading it because it's the end of the laning, but why is it connected to the day of Rosh Hashanah? What thoughts is it supposed to evoke in our mind as we read it? So I appreciate Rabbi Winter mentioning Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch. I'd like to share with you a thought by Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch about this piece of the laning. Rav Hirsch has numerous comments throughout this piece of Chumash, which I think if you pull them all together, actually sheds light and opens up the entirety of this story, and starts to help answer each of these four questions that I've asked this evening. And perhaps, I'd like to suggest, if you really understand Rav Hirsch's interpretation of this passage, perhaps it actually makes it not appendage to the laning, but actually perhaps the most important piece of the laning, perhaps the most important piece of what we're supposed to be thinking about on Rosh Hashanah, on the Yom HaDin. Rav Hirsch explains that Avimelech comes to make a bris with Avram because Avimelech has this gift of being able to see beyond the here and the now. Avimelech had this capacity to see not just what was in front of him, but what could be in front of him down the road. Avimelech could see that today, okay, maybe Avram Avinu was not a threat, maybe Yitzchak was not a threat, but he could see that somewhere down the line, this family could be of great significance and could be a great threat to him in the future. Avimelech had the capacity to dream. He had the capacity to have a vision, to see beyond the here and the now, to see beyond the reality that he faced to a reality that didn't yet exist. And in that moment of interaction between Avimelech and Avram, in the moment of this bris, Avram Avinu learned from Avimelech how to have vision, how to envision a reality that didn't yet exist. how to see beyond the here and the now. And I believe that that lesson shaped every moment of Avram Avinu's life henceforth. Avram's two responses to the bris, planting the tree, calling out in this name of Hashem, I believe are manifestations of this newfound outlook that Avram Avinu had on life. He planted a tree. A tree is the epitome of being able to see beyond the here and the now. You plant some seeds, you plant a sapling, you can't possibly envision what that tree is going to be like 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 100 years from now. You plant it with the faith that one day it's going to grow into something that you couldn't possibly see in the moment that you planted it. And he calls out in the name of Hashem, strange name, Kel Olam, God of the world. Rav Hirsch says, Olam comes from the word Ne'elam, hiddenness. That suddenly Avram Avinu had a newfound appreciation for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as I'll quote what he says, the one who sows the future with invisible seeds in the present. He was somehow able to appreciate that just like Avimelech saw a reality that didn't yet exist, and just like he saw a reality now that didn't yet exist, that's the essence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he's above time, that he's able to see something that doesn't yet exist. He's Kel Olam. He sees the Ne'elam. He sees things that are still hidden from the view of humanity. And if you don't believe me, you don't believe Rav Hirsch, that this was the turning point in Avram Avinu's life, if you don't believe that this treaty between him and Avimelech shaped the way he viewed the world, just look at the context of the story. Look at the story that comes before it, and look at the story that comes after it. The story before it is a story of lack of vision. The story that comes after it is a story all about vision. And this is the story smack in the middle. Before the story of the bris is the story of the banishment of Hagar and Ishmael, as I mentioned before. In that story, Avram Avinu couldn't see what was right before his very eyes. He couldn't see the influence that Ishmael was having on him, on his family, in their own household. Hagar also couldn't see what was right before her very eyes. She couldn't see the Be'er until HaKadosh Baruch Hu opens up her eyes. Avram and Hagar couldn't see into the distance the type of person and leader that Ishmael would one day be. It's a story about lack of vision, lack of ability to see beyond the here and the now. Then all of a sudden you have the story of Avram and Avimelech and the bris. Avram internalizes to the nth degree the ability to see beyond the here and the now, to be able to have a vision of what he doesn't yet see in front of his eyes. And what story comes next? The Akedah. Almost every line of the Akedah story is permeated with the verb of re'iyah, of seeing, of sight. Vayaris hamakom merachok. Avram Avinu is able to see the place in the distance. See the place of the Akedah far beyond him. Not just in the literal sense of being able to see, but in the figurative sense. He was able to see, the Torah declares, something that wasn't in front of his eyes. Something that didn't yet exist. Something that was long into the future. The story of the bris of Avram and Avimelech is a turning point which teaches Avram Avinu to be able to see beyond the here and the now. The reason why we read this story on Rosh Hashanah is because vision is the essence of the Yom HaDin. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is able to forgive us, Naseres Yimei Tshuva, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, because he sees not who we are today, but who we could be tomorrow, and the next day, and the day after that. Our ability to do tshuva is predicated upon our capacity to see ourselves not as stagnant people of who we are today, but the potential of who we could be if we tried harder, if we pushed ourselves into the days and weeks and months and years ahead. It's a day when we're meant to craft a vision of who we want to be in the future and present that vision and present that person before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Vision is perhaps the legacy of Avram Avinu and what is being taught to us in the laning of the first day of Rosh Hashanah. I believe vision is also the legacy of another great Jewish hero, a person who I've always admired and looked up to. You know, on Yamim Noraim, I try to keep in the back of my machzor a couple of things. keep a small index card with some of the tefillos that I like to say, some of the thoughts that I like to keep in my mind. And I also keep a picture before I start davening. I try to look at this picture, not while I'm davening, but beforehand, which inspires me. One of them is a picture of my children, and the other one is a picture of this person. And that is the Piazetzner Rebbe, Klonimus Kalman Shapiro, many of you have probably heard of. The Piazetzner Rebbe, I believe, is a person who captures this essence of Avraham Avinu, of this piece of the laning, and of what Rosh Hashanah as Yom HaDin is all about, the ability to see beyond the here and the now, the ability to envision a reality that doesn't exist. That's the story of his life, those of you who don't know. Piazetzner Rebbe was a young up-and-coming Rebbe in the town of Piazetzner before in Poland, before World War II, before the Holocaust. During the Holocaust, he came into the Warsaw Ghetto, became really the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, an inspiring person, a great teacher, a person who gave a lot of chizuk to those who were living through the worst nightmare of their lives. And he spent his time doing what he loved most, which was teaching children. And as he saw his son, his daughter, his family killed before his very eyes, his community disappearing, every vestige of hope disappearing, he wrote a sefer, wrote sfarim, and he buried them beneath the buildings in the Warsaw Ghetto with a note that said, after the war, if anybody finds this, they should send it to such and such place, to my relative in Eretz Yisrael, should publish these words and spread them. For him to believe that a world would exist after the Holocaust, for him to believe that a Jewish world would exist after the Holocaust, for him to believe that a Jewish world would exist after the Holocaust that could read his Sfarim and be inspired by his words took tremendous vision. The ability to see beyond his reality. His reality dictated to him that the world was done, that it was over. And yet he had the inspiration, the vision to bury his works, and they were found, and they were published. And we are the recipients of the incredible words which he spoke. And one line, two lines in particular, which he wrote, remind me of the vision of Avraham Avinu, and are words that I try to remind myself of before Rosh Hashanah. I'll say parenthetically, actually, I was always felt very connected to his Sfarim. But I was living in Washington Heights, and one day I was parking my car. Those of you who know Washington Heights, I lived on Overlook Terrace. It's a big, big hill on Overlook Terrace. And I was parking my car, and I got out and I saw there was an elderly man walking down this hill. There's a fence next to the sidewalk on this hill. And I could see he was having trouble walking down, and he was clutching the fence, you know, for dear life. He was afraid to fall. So I got in my car, and I went over, and I offered to walk him down the hill. And I was very happy because, you know, a stranger walks up to you in New York, you don't necessarily think they're going to accept your help. But he did. And I had this bliss to walk down this hill with him. So I tried to make conversation. I said, you know, what's your name? Where are you from? And I could tell he had an accent. Came out in the course of our conversation that he was a Holocaust survivor. He was a child during the war. And he said he was a child in the Warsaw Ghetto. And I said, oh, it's a long shot, but I might as well ask him if he knew the Piazetzner Rebbe. I'd asked other people this question. They all said no. I said, he was in the Warsaw Ghetto. He was a child. I said, did you happen to know the Piazetzner Rebbe? He said, Piazetzner Rebbe? He was my Rebbe. I learned with him. I held his hand. I danced with him. I was blown away. We walked not only down the hill together, I walked him all the way home. I couldn't leave this man. And from then on, I felt even deeper connection to the Piazetzner Rebbe. I felt I had a living connection to his Torah, to his teachings, and to his vision. His vision is captured in this one line, two lines. In his Sefer Tzav Vezirus, he says, if you want to grow in Avodas Hashem, you want to succeed in Avodas Hashem, he says, B'chol Shana, Aselecha Matara. Every year, make for yourself a goal. How do you make a goal for yourself? Listen to what he says. Tzayer be'atzmecha. Draw for yourself. Imagine for yourself. Im shimcha Ruven l'mashal, if your name is Ruven, for example, eze Ruven tie b'shana haba'a. Imagine for yourself. Draw a picture for yourself. Envision for yourself who you want to be in the year to come. What kind of person you want to be next year at this time. Ma yu hasagosav avodaso midosav v'chol tachno. Imagine who that person will be. What will be their achievements? What will be their nature? What would be their avoda? What would be their midos? What will be the essence of this person who you're envisioning for the future? V'im higia shana haba'a, if next year comes, umadadata et atzmecha v'lo higata afilu l'karsulei ha-re'uven shel shana ha-chadasha. If you come to next year and you haven't even reached the feet, the ankles of the Reuven who you envisioned, of the self that you envisioned, iye be'necha shechas v'shalom chalila v'chas lo arachta yamim, then it will be as if you didn't have length of days, as if you didn't succeed, because that's the essence of life. That's the essence of what we present before HaKadosh Baruch Hu on the Yom HaDin. Is a picture not of who we are today, but who we want to be in the future. Utilizing the vision of Avraham Avinu, the vision of the Piyazetzin Rebbe, we should all be successful in not only creating that vision, but living up to that vision of the people that we want to be in the year to come. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees us devoted to that vision, to that Tzayer Be'atzmecha, with the utmost of sincerity, then he should accept that as our tefillah, as our avoda, give us a ksiva chasima tova, sefer chaim tovim, a great year ahead.
Thank you, Rabbi Weinberg, for your remarkable and powerful message. Rabbi Reingold is very well known to us here, so doesn't need a lengthy introduction. But I think I'll take the opportunity. We have people from all over the community, from White Oak, from Camille, from Potomac, from Rockville. And I think it's worthwhile to just speak out and to contemplate the moment, really, of the tremendous benefit that we've had from Rabbi Reingold. Wherever you are in Greater Washington, if not directly, you have gained from Rabbi Reingold indirectly, I could assure you. If you never met Rabbi Reingold, you've gained and benefited from Rabbi Reingold. And this comes from the tremendous Torah of the yeshiva as a center of Torah, as a tremendous Makom Torah, as setting a standard for Limud Torah and scholarship, for Rabbi Reingold's and Mrs. Reingold's tremendous chesed and the tzibur in his tremendous koach and psak, which he's always available as a resource, both to Rabbanim and as individuals. And it's truly, really an honor for me to have my own personal relationship with Rabbi Reingold and to have him here benefiting this maimed. Without further ado, I'd like to call him Rabbi Reingold.
I'd first like to thank Rabbi Winter for giving me the opportunity to share some words of Torah with you. I thank Kadosh Baruch Hu daily that I'm zoicha to do what I like the most, which is to learn Torah and to teach Torah and to do chesed. It's a beautiful chelik that I have in Chaim, and the opportunity to be part of that is something which I bless at Kadosh Baruch Hu daily in my tefillos and moedim and nachtu loch, that I'm zoicha to be able to do what I love to do, which is to teach Torah. So I want to thank you for allowing me to do that. I want to take an opportunity to recognize the contribution that Rabbi Winter has made to the community, so the Karlo has made to the community, Baruch Hashem, bringing Torah, spreading Torah throughout the community is a wonderful thing. Furthermore, this event, I think, is a beautiful thing. If it's late, if somebody needs to leave, please feel free to leave. I will not be insulted. If you fall asleep, I will not be insulted. I'm very happy that you got a chance to get a good rest. So I was mazaka, a yid, with something which is good for them. And that's fine. That's my attitude when I speak. This way, you know, the expectations are set low. Whatever you get afterwards is going to be great. Come on. Okay, gotta start somewhere. I feel horrible speaking right now, because I'm going to be a spoiler for the last three drushas. And that's like, why do you want to do that? But the last three drushas were very inspired, and I'm very inspired. I'm already like maybe thinking, maybe I shouldn't say what I'm about to say, because like, you know, we're going to move the expectations down a little bit and try and make them as real as possible, because we know that we grapple with it. Maybe I'm a little bit older, and I grapple with the problem, and I once asked my Rosh Hashiva the same question. I seem to be grappling with the same issues year after year. And I come to Rosh Hashanah, and I look like I looked a year ago, I look like I looked 2 years ago. And I've been inspired, I've been trying, I've been working on it. Thank you very much. So I once asked my Rosh Hashiva, Rosh Hashiva Chaim Steinzer, for the bracha, I'm grappling with this issue. I seem to be sitting in my Rosh Hashanah, and I feel very similar to the last year. I didn't make any major changes. So he says to me, what do you think I feel like? You know, I said, oh, thank you, Rebbe. I feel much better now. And I want to look forward to the future. Not only do I have a problem now, for the last 40 years, he says, I've had it for the last 80 years. Wow, I feel so much better now. Right? But I want to give you a way to make you feel better about it. But at the same time, let's see if we can make some real change. So, you're familiar with this idea, which many of the Baalei Musar talk about, that when you make a Kabbalah for the Yom Ha'Nuroim, or you make a change for the Yom Ha'Nuroim, it should be small. Yeah, like, and usually this comes with, you got Rabbi Pesach Kron gets up, and he says, and he touts out the fact that Rabbi Shach, 1 year he made his Kabbalah, he's going to bench from a bencher for the coming year. And say, wow, that's not very big. Okay, so let's understand exactly what's happening over here. So you're going to come to the Yom Ha'Din, and in Shemayim, there's this very big scale, gigantic scale. And on the scale, they start putting the Averus. And the Averus are getting very, very, very big. And they're very scary. He said, 1 second, I have on the other side a benching from a bencher. Baruch Hashem, who's going to win? Really? How does it work? Explain it to me. You know, so, you know, like, what does that mean? Just make a small change, everything's going to be wonderful. So let's talk about small changes. Because that's really what we're aiming for, because large changes is not how we're going to go. The Vilna Gaon says, there's a pasuk in Mishlei, Ivelus Adam Tiselef Darkoi, Vel Hashem Yizaf Liboi. Person makes a foolish ideas, it makes his path unsuccessful, and he's angry at Hashem. That's what the pasuk says. So the Vilna Gaon explains it as Pirush Mishlei. What does it mean? It means like this. A person tries to go too fast and is avoided as Hashem. If you go too fast, it does not work. And he comes to Kadosh Baruch Hu and says, I was so inspired. I wanted to change so much, and it didn't work. Why didn't you help me? And Baruch Hu says, what do you want from me? Your foolishness of going too fast made it not be successful. Ivelus Adam, the foolishness of the person, Tisal Dakar, made his path be crooked. And then you're angry at Hashem. Why didn't you help me? What do you want from me? You blow it. So we're going to have to find a way to work, which is going to work step by step. And Chaim Volozhiner, in his Ruach Chaim, picking up from where his Rebbe left off, gives a mashal to this. And he says, that there was a master one time said to his Eved, I need you to go up to the loft and bring something down. So Bella starts getting a ladder. He says, we never envisioned that the master said, 1 second, no, I didn't ask you to get a ladder. I said, jump. Obviously, he didn't say jump. He said, get a ladder and go up step by step. And why are we trying to jump when all the Kadosh Baruch Hu wants us to do is to go up step by step? The Telzer Rav in Shirei Das, I'm a Telzer, so I have to say the Telzer word. Telzer Rav in Shirei Das has a fascinating idea about the significance of a small change. He says, imagine for a moment this building. Imagine for a moment a field, a soccer field, filled with sesame seeds. One sesame seed high. That's it. One sesame seed high. How many sesame seeds are there? Rabosai?
Billions,
okay? Good. All right? Now add another layer of sesame seeds on top of that. One sesame seed high. Do you see the difference? Rabosai?
No.
No. Did you make, what did you add? Billions of sesame seeds. A human being is connected to every part of the Bria. The whole universe is connected to the human being. A mashu of a change has raised every part of the whole world, the whole universe, as a mashu higher. It's just a small change, but the whole world has changed. Number one. Number two, he says that the mashal is not really good, because if you think about it for a second, when you add another layer of sesame seeds, what do you get? Another layer of sesame seeds. A human being adds a mashu, he's a different person. You're not the same person because you changed even a little bit. We have to integrate that small changes are valuable, because that means we are a different person than we were before. Number one. Number two, Reb Chatzkel Levenstein, when he talks about the idea of making small changes, he says the following. He says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not like sheker. He actually hates sheker, because so much of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is emes. A small, real change, which is emes, is much more valuable to him than this ephemeral attempt at something greater and convincing yourself that you've done something great when really you haven't really changed, because you bit off too much. So our goal is going to be something small. Okay, but let's go back to this scale, you know. Okay, that's great. You know, I understand. Like, you know, we have this small change, and it's a real change, and this year I bench for a bench, and every time I have a better, greater appreciation of benching. So we shouldn't disparage that. That's a wonderful thing. My benching is different. You know what I mean? That a Jew benches, and I could spend, we get up here, and I've had a lot of time, I could spend an hour talking about the value of benching, and now your benching is better. Can we disparage? We can't disparage that. But how does it work against that scale? How does it work on that scale? I would like to suggest the following. There's a Gemara Kedushin. The Gemara Kedushin says a fascinating thing. The Gemara Kedushin says that by a Jew, a Kadosh Baruch Hu has an approach to the actions of a Jew called that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is Mitzarif Machshava Toive Olamaisa and not Mitzarif Machshava Ruah Olamaisa. Which means, if a Jew desires to do something and an oinus happens and he can't do it, he gets credit as if he has done it. If a Jew desires to do something bad and he can't do it, he doesn't get it. Even though he was only stopped due to an oinus, it was against his will. He was ready to do it. And an oinus stopped him. It's not considered as if he did it. So fascinatingly, the Sfas Emes and Rosh Hashanah, Rosh Hashanah in Parshas Re'eh, and Rosh Hashanah in Igeres Lamed of Or Yisrael, both say the same word. Now you have to, this is like the Chassidus of one side and the Muslim from the other side, right? Rabbi from Tel Shishiva is telling over Sfas Emes over here from the podium. And in Silver Spring, it's quite a combination. And here the Sfas Emes says the following. The essence of a Jew is good. When a Jew does something wrong, it's mikra, it's an occasion, it's something which happened against the nature of the reality of the person. A mikra is only a mikra when it happens. And something occurs only when it occurred. Because until it occurs, it's not supposed to occur. Whereas toiv is the essence of a Jew. And therefore, even if he is not able to do it, he's limited from his ability to do it, but he wants to do it. That's defining who he is, and therefore he gets credit as if he has done it. A Jew comes to him in the room and says, Rav Hashem, I would like to be like Rabbi Weinberg said so beautifully. That Ruvein, which is a gorgeous different person the way I am, right? I would like to be a person who loves everybody and has no grievances. Remove that anger. Remove that revenge. Remove that frustration. I'd be a person who's my davening is a davening and my learning is a learning. I would love all of that. I want that with every single fiber of my being. I can't do that. I realistically cannot do that. I'm not supposed to do that. That's not what I'm supposed to be working on, because it will not work. I am an onus. Not from an outside problem, but the intrinsic being of who I am. My neshama is burning with a fire. My neshama is screaming, I want to change. But the Russian gave me not just a neshama, he gave me a goof. He gave me a body, he gave me circumstances, he gave me challenges, he gave me limitations. So what can I do? I can change as much as is realistic for me. When I do that, what am I saying? I'm ready to change as much as I can. I can't do more. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, I will count that as if you've done full tshuva. And now on this scale of all these averas, I have a full tshuva. Because the Kadosh Baruch Hu will count that I'm trying as best as I can, which is very limited. But it's real. How can I get that schus from the Kadosh Baruch Hu? What I can do, I must do. Because if what I can do, I don't do, then it's not real. Then I'm saying, Rosh, I don't really care. What I'm saying is, I do really care. I really want to change. I will change as much as I can, which might be one thing. But that's okay, as long as that's real. The author from the Baruch asked the Kasha, famous Medrash, famous Chazal. The Rosh says, if you open for me a Pesach, kechudah shalmachet, like the eye of a needle, I will open for you, and actually the language of the Medrash is an opening which is so large that wagons could roll through it in both directions. There'd be wagons going in, wagons going out. This is a gigantic opening. It's referring to the idea of a person changing. If you make a small change, I'm going to give you a phenomenal ability to change to beyond any expectation you ever would believe. And he asks the question. We don't seem to see that happening to us. But we do have moments of hira tshuva, which we really open that opening, and we really want to change, and we really care. And why are we not getting these openings, which are phenomenal? Why am I not that gigantic, wonderful person the next year? What's wrong? Why is it working? Because Al said it's going to work. What's wrong? So he says the following. He says, there are many ways to make a hole. Many things you can make a hole in. You can make a hole in water. You have a big thing of water, you stick your hand in, you made a hole in it. You know what happens if you take your hand out? No hole. You put your finger into a stick of margarine and it pushes through. The stick of margarine melts and it comes back together again. And you can drill a hole in metal. You drill a hole in metal, it's going to last. Chazal's mashal is a chudosh shel machat. It's the hole in an eye of a needle in metal, in a metal needle. This is a real change. And the reason why we're not getting, he says, is because we have not found ways to make our changes real. And Rabbi, we make fun of New Year's resolutions by the Goyim, and I, honestly, we really want to change. And somewhere along the way, by Hanukkah, we want to say, what were we accomplished for this year? So to really organize people, which I'm not one of those, like, you know, will have this piece of paper in their wallet, which they'll take out every single day and they'll read before davening what their Kabbalahs were for the year. I have to first write the piece of paper. That's a challenge for me, to remember to write the piece of paper. To remember it's in my wallet. To remember to take it out and make sure it was legible enough to read it. By the time I get to Hanukkah, what that was, I'm a Kabbal is the problem. Honestly. And the answer is, I was talking about dreams. And dreams are very important because dreams, the only way you're going to have goals is if you have dreams. But we're not talking about dreams over here. That's not a chudosh machat. We're talking about goals. You dream of what that person is supposed to look like. And you say, okay, you know what? I can't do all of that in this life, in this year. Forget about my lifetime. I can't do it in this year for sure. What one step can I do towards that picture, which will be real? A, how am I going to make sure that it's going to last? What am I going to do? What are the impediments that are going to prevent me from making that happen? You come to Yom Kippur and you say, and you have the Rabbi Cronin points out in his Vidi booklet, which came out many years ago and it's picked up by other people, that most of the, over one fourth of what we talk about is, has to do with the time of our Lashon. And we don't like saying Lashon Hara. We don't like being bad people. I'm not going to speak Lashon Hara again this year. And you decide with such a definitiveness. And the next day you meet your old friend who came back for Sukkot that you haven't seen, and he asks you, so what's going on with the new rabbi? What are you going to say? What's your plan? I don't mean like practically. How? You know the problem. It happened last year. It happened 2 years ago. It's not a chiddush. If you haven't worked out a real plan, how are you going to deal with that? You have not done tshuva. You haven't really changed. That's not a chiddush shalmachat. I want to leave you with one, and now you can project that forward. So you know what? Realistically, I'm not going to deal with that situation. Fine, so you haven't made a Kabbalah yet for that point. What do you want to make, which is a real Kabbalah? Your Lashon Hara is a problem. What are you going to do? Let's start with the easy things, Rabbi Sosalta says. There's a greater earnest. If you don't put tzitzis in the white part, then if you don't put the blue part, the Mora says, because the blue part is expensive. I understand why it's challenging. Why are you putting the white tzitzis in? What's the excuse for that? It's easy. Just change. Do the easy ones first. The kalos in each avera, there are the kavedos and the kalos. At least change the kalos. What can I do which is easier to do? want to leave you with a thought from Rabbi Silsalanta. Rabbi Silsalanta says a fascinating thing. There's a Gemara. We mentioned this in Yom Nerurim davening at the end, in the Elul. And we quote these psukim from Yechezkel, which are these gorgeous psukim. And Kadosh Baruch Hu says, "Hechavotz, hechavotz, memois ameis. Do I want memois Russia? Do I want the Russia to die? I don't want a Russia to die. Ki meshuva midrachav v'chay. I want him to do tshuva." The Russia says, "I don't want to punish a Russia. I don't want you to die. I want you to live. Please help me." And then we have these psukim. There's three psukim like that, powerful psukim. And the Gemara Nida, the Mamash at the end of Shas, the Adafai and Aleph, the Gemara says, it's a Sirik, there's a Pasuk in Shmuel which says, Ki chafetz Hashem l'amish, Hashem wanted to kill B'nai Eli. Versus, I don't want to kill Rishon, but I wanted to kill B'nai Eli, it's a Sirik. And the Gemara answers, Kan b'sois in Shuvah, kan b'sois in Shuvah. The ones who are not doing Shuvah, chafetz Hashem l'amish, the ones who are going to do Shuvah, Hashem wants them to live. Now, that doesn't make the card, the Gemara does not make any sense. The Pasuk is talking about a Russia. If he did Tshuva, he's not a Russia anymore. So who is this Pasuk talking about? Is an Oysa Tshuva, who's a Russia still? He didn't do Tshuva yet. So what's it? What defines a person who's an Oysa Tshuva? He will do Tshuva. As opposed to a person who will not do Tshuva. Now that he's done Tshuva yet, like Rabbi Weinberg said, we're talking about, the verse is giving us a credit. You will do Tshuva. How do we know? What defines whether you are a Oysa Tshuva or a not Oysa Tshuva? Now, the Kadosh Baruch Hu knows. The Kadosh Baruch Hu, in his all-seeing vision, knows that 17 years down the road, there's going to be this terrible accident, the person's going to get into an accident, and he's going to become a paraplegic, and he's going to change his whole life and do Tshuva. That doesn't count. Because that's the Russian's business, and what is it with us? He says, the difference between whether you're Oysa Tshuva or not is whether it bothers you. You're chai margish. The difference between a chai and a mace is you put a machet in the basar of a mace, it doesn't feel it. And a chai feels. Does it bother you? If it truly bothers you, not just I wish I was better, but if it truly bothers you, you'll do Tshuva. And if it doesn't really bother you, you're not going to do Tshuva. That's the Gemara is talking about. And Yisrael Salanta says, the Sifra Chaim and Sifra Mason, we write ourselves. If we're a Chai, we're Margish, when Jesus really bothers us, and we're going to do Tshuva, we're in the Sifra Chaim. And if we're not, we're amazed, we go in the Sifra Mason. We get to write which book we go into, he says. He says, how are you going to make sure that you are a chai margish, that you're going to really make some change? He says, you have to learn Musa. This is Rishon Lezion talking, right? It's not the Sozab is talking, it's Rishon Lezion talking. You have to make a commitment in the coming year that you're going to constantly look for inspiration. You're going to look for introspection. You're going to find time in your day or your week where you're going to sit there and think, be it daily, be it weekly, am I moving forward towards that goal that I set for myself? The small goal that I set for myself. And if you will do that, you will change. And then you will be nichtav, v'nechtam, v'alto l'chaim tov mitzolom, in the Sefer HaChayim. Rabbi said, we should all be zoicha to write ourselves, as Hashem, into the Sefer HaChayim. And Bereshit will put his stamp of approval. All clients will be zoicha to be nichtav, v'nechtam, l'chaim tov mitzolom, together with doing Oysa Tshuva and the Russian with that school, will bring Mashiach. See, can't be here.